Pocket Issue for all women.
Hello and welcome to episode 152 of the Standard Issue Podzine. I'm Mickey Noonan and yesterday I ordered 9 metres of bees. You heard me.
Bees!
That's a very Job Bluth statement.
I was on a segue at the time.
I don't understand. Explain, please.
You ordered bees by the metre, Jen. No, they're
bees for what?
They are fairy light bees for our garden, for our little wedding reception.
Okay, I see. That makes more sense.
I'm Hannah Dunleavy, and I am newly vaccinated.
Hooray!
Hurrah! Mm.
She's the first in. She's feeling the side effects now, but otherwise, good job.
I'm feeling very, very, very hungry, and nobody warned me that that was the side effect of this. Do you know, I asked a woman who was there, like, wiping down the seats yesterday that people were sitting on, and, you know me, ever the journalist, hi, why are you here and why are you doing this? I said, are you doing this out of the goodness of your heart? And she said, well, I do get a free lunch, but mostly, yes, out of the goodness of my heart. And I said, why? And she said, it makes me feel less powerless than I have previously. So if anyone is one of the people who's working at a vaccination centre, well done. Like, well done for
getting
up your time for doing that.
Right now, though, if you saw her again, would you wrestle her for her free lunch?
Yeah, actually, probably. I might have to go and volunteer just so I can, have more meals. More meals.
I'm Jen Offord, and I finally got to do a mum and baby hangout last week, and now I'm sick. So, business as usual.
Children are germ farms. Oh. I warned you of this when you had one.
No, it's the next 5 years of my life, isn't it? Just
five?
Come on, Jen. Oh, look, Jen's got some optimism.
When do they have a fucking immune system? I don't know.
I think, like, it's just being around other kids. It's until they're at least 32,
oh,
I think.
God.
Yeah. Sorry.
What have I done?
Wait till she gives you nits.
Oh,
God. Oh, no, that just made me really itchy in the head. Later on, I chat with Laura Parmiani, Artistic Director of Legal Aliens Theatre Company, about its series of podcasts turning assumptions around migrant women on their head.
I speak to journalist and author Helen Russell about why we need to stop fearing sadness. And in Jenny Off the Blocks, I'm talking Super Leagues, Megabucks and Red Roses.
And in Rated or Dated, we're watching Gregory's Girl. Modern girls, modern boys. It's tremendous.
But first, dodgy dealings, hope and hard work and great knobs of the ocean. It's time for the Bush Telegraph. Cue Sting.
Telegraph.
Welcome to the Bush Telegraph. We'd like to thank our mums and dads for having sex.
I'm pretty sure listeners can hear the face I'm pulling. Yeah. Daniel, you're Oscar winning awesome, but I need to get far away from that thought. Keep talking, Jen.
Okay. Mick, who would you least like to have your competence and integrity questioned by? Jeff Bezos? I suppose he's actually quite competent, to be fair. FIFA? Any member of the current cabinet? I would say Boris Johnson, except he's the person whose competence and integrity is being questioned.
What?
Big surprise, right? I've always thought he seemed like a man of... No, I haven't. I imagine that he was quite surprised, however, when his former advisor, Dominic Suspicious Tote Bag Carrier Cummings, launched a scathing attack on him at the weekend.
There are so many different things you could have put in between Dominic and Cummings.
Do you know what? I was going to say that. I was like, there's so many things you could have... But the thing that I always think about him is like how like weird he looks carrying a little canvas tote bag.
You could have stopped at how weird he looks.
Yes, he does look really weird, but it's the tote bag thing. I find it...
unnerving.
Yeah, on a man who's like advising the Prime Minister. I don't want to see it. I want to see a fucking briefcase, and that's... Anyway... We've gone on a tangent here. So the attack was in relation to, I don't know, do you want to guess?
Again, there's so much.
Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't in relation to him failing to disclose how many children he has or how many extramarital affairs he's conducted. Sorry, judgy.
Unfair play to judge. But also, I like the idea that you think he's just not disclosing numbers as opposed to doesn't know himself.
Good point. I reckon he's got a ballpark figure, but
he does look a bit like a ballpark.
In fact, it was about the revelations last week that Johnson sent texts to Sir James Dyson assuring him that his employees would not have to pay extra tax if they came to the UK to make ventilators to help the NHS at the peak, the first one, of the COVID pandemic. Johnson responded via text, "I will fix it," which does sound a bit dodgy, doesn't it, to be fair, but anyway... That was in response to Dyson asking if Singapore-based staff would see a change in tax status if it went ahead. Hello, says Bojo. What's dodgy or rum or weird about trying to secure more ventilators during the pandemic? More dodgy, says number 10. Who the fuck leaked this? Back to Cummings, who says, not me, but he does also crucially claim that there's a fuck ton more where that came from. For example, and this is dodgy and weird, I'm not sure about rum because I've never heard that expression before in my life.
I don't know how you've not heard that expression. Oh, he's a rumman.
Have you heard it before?
Yeah, loads.
Oh, I thought it was some weird, like, when he says piffle and stuff like that, and you're like, no one fucking says that. Anyway, Cummings alleges that Johnson asked Tory donors to pay for renovations to the Downing Street flat. Doesn't ask, doesn't get, right? Now, Ben Wallace, remember him? He's the Defence Secretary. No, me either. He says Boris Johnson complied with the rules over said refurbishment. Okay, cool. I'll definitely take his word for it and not ask for any kind of independent inquiry. Incidentally, Wallace also denies Monday's Daily Mail front page splash that Boris is accused by an unidentified source of saying during a meeting in October that he would rather, and I quote, let the bodies pile high than enter into a third UK lockdown. So, Boris, your people are waiting for you on Oxford Street, babes.
Well, there's at least four different podcasts that could come out of this. There's a very chatty rat or two in Downing Street, isn't there?
It's a lot, isn't it? I might go as far as to say that someone has got their fucking knives out for the PM.
Let's go over to America. On Tuesday the 20th of April, following 3 weeks of testimony, it took the jury just over 9 hours to find white former police officer Derek Chauvin guilty of murdering George Floyd by kneeling on his neck for more than 9 minutes. Nothing is going to bring George Floyd back to his family, his friends, to the world, but this verdict, the right verdict, is hopefully a step forward for justice. It was a murder in full light of day and it ripped the blinders off for the whole world to see, said US President Joe Biden. And can we just take a moment to note how we barely mentioned Joe Biden since his inauguration? And that's because he's not doing mad shit in capital letters on a daily basis. And if this particular moment in American history isn't the one to fully appreciate that we're not hearing what Donald Trump thinks about it all, I'm not sure what that would be. Anyway, Chauvin was found guilty of second-degree murder, third-degree murder and second-degree manslaughter. We've mentioned before on the podcast that the American justice system and the various degrees of murder and manslaughter is complicated to bend your head around, but the take-home from this is that Chauvin could face up to 40 years in prison. In remarks to the nation just hours after the verdict was announced, standing alongside Vice President Kamala Harris at the White House, Biden called systemic racism a stain on our nation's soul after Veep Harris demanded that the lives of Americans of colour be valued in our education system, in our healthcare system, in our housing system, in our economic system, in our criminal justice system, in our nation, full stop. Because yes, racism in the American police forces is a huge problem, but it's the tip of the iceberg and there is a lot of work to be done. Basic accountability isn't a massive ask, and yet time and time again, Americans of colour are made to feel that it is. This verdict really is a small step forward for hope. Hope that this is a start on the road to true justice and accountability, because fuck knows for the black men, women and children who have suffered so unfathomably, and for society as a whole, it needs to be. But would we be here right now if this murder had not been filmed? I don't know that we would. Darnella Frazier demonstrated huge courage in filming what she knew was wrong, and she deserves credit for enabling this verdict to happen. I'd add that there's something else that would make a huge difference in America, and that is, and no surprises here, gun control. Before we even get to the blatant batshittery of the Second Amendment, when you look at it with even a smidgen of logic, guns on the streets means guns on the cops means guns on the street means etc. 106 people are killed every day by guns in the country, something which Biden has called an epidemic. And gun control is an uphill task, but Biden is on it to some extent, enacting new measures, which include efforts to set rules for certain guns, bolster background checks and support local violence prevention, through an executive order. And by using an executive order, it means he doesn't need approval from Congress, which is currently the only way around things, as right now there are not enough votes in Congress to enact even modest new gun laws. It is another small, hopeful step, though. I'll take it.
The point about guns is like, yeah, there is absolutely no doubt in my mind whatsoever that we wouldn't see more situations like that over here between the police and people of colour. Like, there's no doubt in my mind at all. It's just the fact that, obviously, with a gun, the immediacy of it is, you know, if you get shot, there's a good chance you're dying. So it's awful. It's very much here as well. And I think, like, we can't be complacent about that.
Oh, yeah, 100% agree with you. Yeah.
Anyway, would you like some good news, Mick?
Oh, for fuck's sake, yes, please, Jen. Get it in my ears.
Well, you may remember some time ago a lockdown baby boom was predicted. Fair play, it's not like anyone's had much else to do, though I wouldn't necessarily recommend giving birth during a global pandemic, unless you happen to be a sea creature, in which case I say knob away, which is exactly what the aquatic beasts of sea life centres across the UK have been doing. Do cow nose rays have knobs? I don't know.
Would you like to know, Jenster?
I'd love to know.
Well, good, because I'm going to tell you. Cow nose rays, and indeed all rays, have two knobs.
Shut up, really?
Sort of. At sexual maturity, male rays have external sexual organs called claspers, visible near the base of the tail, and effectively these are two penis-like organs that lie within modified pelvic fins and are used to internally fertilise the female. Thank you, practicalfishkeeping.co.uk.
That is practical.
I'm going to let you get back to the story, but thanks for making my Google search history as suspect as the time I checked the phrase wet as an otter's pocket to prove a point.
Well, they have been doubly knobbing then. Anyway, cow nose rays have been making the most of their time out of the public eye, says the Sea Life Centre.
Are they shy?
Yeah, they don't like to do it when there's people watching.
What, if human men had two knobs, I don't think they'd be shy about it.
So the Trafford branch have welcomed not one, but two very rare aquarium births of the little critters. One of them was named Bevan after the founder of the NHS, and that's nice, isn't it?
Like that. Approve.
But that's not all. There are pyjama sharks in Scarborough and guitar sharks in Hunstanton. And apart from anything else, now I know of the existence of pyjama and guitar sharks. And that's just bloody lovely.
I feel like they should form a band.
Yeah, I agree. Did you know that there were pyjama sharks and guitar sharks?
Guitar sharks is new to me, but pyjama sharks, yeah, I knew about them.
Oh,
I love a shark, Jen. You know that. More news next week.
Well, you have equal pay, but, you know, they're not equal, are they?
Sexism of the week. It's that time of the week where we ask whether data from 18th century France is a reliable marker of a woman's usefulness. I mean, I could make this a very short section by just recording the noise my head makes as it repeatedly hits a brick wall, but let's go a little more in depth. A new study published in the Journal of the American Medical Association reveals the number of reproductive years for women in the United States has increased from 35 to 37.1. Why so? Well, it turns out the average age of menopause has gone up, while the average age of the first period has gone down, leading to more baby-making time. An average of 37.1 years of baby-making time, in fact, which kind of raises the question, what's that age-old nonsense about 35 being the age women fall off a fertility cliff all about then? Age-old is right, that magic number, after which you're officially described as being of advanced maternal age or a geriatric mother, given dire warnings about how hard it will be to get pregnant and all the problems you and your baby might face if you do, and with any pregnancy immediately labelled high risk and subject to extra monitoring, is outdated and unscientific because it's based on a bunch of church birth records from 300 years ago, when life expectancy was 30 years old. But you know, if it shames and scares women, don't fix it, as the saying goes. I am going to fix it, though. Well, me and a much more recent bit of research from 2004, which looked at 770 European women and found that, with sex at least twice a week, 78% of women aged 35 to 40 conceived within a year, a stat not far off 84% of women aged 20 to 34. Yes, the quality of eggs decline over time, whereas sperm ages like good cheese. Oh, wait, of course it fucking doesn't. The fact is, fertility is complicated. It's affected by loads of different variables and therefore incredibly different for each individual. Giving up the number 35 as a shame bell for women seems the very least the medical profession could do.
I would just like to say, as some anecdotal evidence for this, that I gave birth to my first child at the age of 37, and I would say that certainly in one of my local mums groups, I was probably on the younger side, mm-hmm. actually, of a lot of the mums. That's Hackney for you, lots of, you know, professional women. But, like, yeah, it's bollocks, isn't it? It's absolute bollocks. I am joined by journalist and author Helen Russell. Hello, Helen.
Hello.
Helen, you are here today to talk to me about your new book, How to Be Sad, which we're going to come on to in a minute. But I wanted to ask you, first of all, reading around your book a little bit, you have spent 8 years studying cultural approaches to emotions, which I thought sounded quite interesting. And I know that you live in Denmark now, so perhaps that's part of this. I wondered if you could just tell me a little bit more about that.
Yeah, and it definitely does have a real link to the Denmark thing. So I lived and worked in London for 12 years. I was a journalist. I was at marieclaire.co.uk. And then one day, out of the blue, my husband came home and told me he'd been offered his dream job working for Lego in Denmark. And we knew nothing about Denmark at the time beyond Nordic Noir and the fact that it kept being voted the happiest country in the world. So I started with my journalist head on looking into this and discovered that this tiny country, just 5.6 million people, had actually been voted one of the happiest countries in the world in studies going back to the 1970s. So it wasn't just this recent thing. So we visited one weekend, just checked the place out, and noticed immediately that things were a bit different. People were more relaxed. There was a better work-life balance. People spent a lot of time outdoors. And I had been quite stressed in London. I was quite burnt out. I'd been having fertility treatment to try and start a family for years. I was broken. So it felt as though this other life possibility had been dangled in front of us. So we went for it. I resigned from my job. I went freelance. We moved all of our life in boxes across the North Sea. And I started to investigate this Danish happiness phenomenon. I was working, writing for UK newspapers. And then I wrote a book about my experiences, looking at different areas of Danish life to find out what they did differently. And so that became my first book, The Year of Living Danishly, which was published all around the world, which is lovely. But I started to hear from readers all around the world saying, well, this is what they do in Denmark, but here in my country, in Brazil, we like to do this. And, you know, in Portugal and in Spain. And so I started really gathering these ideas together, these different cultural concepts of happiness, and exploring what that meant, what the good life meant around the world. Different countries have different approaches, some are more individualistic, some are more communal. And so really, I spent the last 8 years really doing deep dives into these different cultural approaches, which threw up interesting things about sadness as well. So that's where I came to when I started writing this.
How do the Brits, where do we kind of fall on the scale of happiness?
Oh, I mean, not brilliant, I have to say. I think... we do cheerfulness pretty well in the UK, I think, but we're not always necessarily properly happy. And, you know, long working hours, and we have the NHS, which is fantastic, but there are more and more challenges around access to healthcare, access to education, all of these structural things that have a massive impact on happiness that I think in the UK people are sometimes unwilling to look at.
In the sort of blurb of your book, it says, after 8 years of investigating happiness, Helen Russell discovered a startling fact. Most of us are terrified of being sad. What did you discover?
Back when we could travel, I would talk about my work around the world, and I'd do events and go on panels. But people would come up to me afterwards and talk to me and often they would share, because I write quite personally, so people would share their own experiences and stories, and it kept coming up time and again, people asking me in a very vulnerable way how they can be happy. And these are often at times in their life when this really wasn't possible. I had people asking, how can I be happy when they just lost a loved one, or they had been made redundant, or lost their homes, or, you know, had caring responsibilities that felt overwhelming. And it really struck me that these were people who were, I guess, a self-selecting group, because they had come to an event I'd done, or they had been reading my work, and so they were so interested in the pursuit of happiness that they had developed almost a phobia of feeling sad. And there was a feeling that we must try and be happy above all else, when actually happiness, you know, comes in pockets. It's these delicious moments, but it's not all the time. And so I felt a real need to redress that, really. And really, sometimes we need to be sad. Sadness is important. It's a message that can tell us what is wrong and what to do about it. And I think culturally, if we are scared of being sad, when sadness inevitably happens, which it does to all of us, then we are less equipped to know how to handle it, because it feels overwhelming. And if we don't talk about it enough, then it can feel very isolating for those experiencing it, and hard for people around them to be able to support in a way that we might want to. So I felt like this was something really important to talk about, and this was pre-COVID. And in the last year, I think it has borne out that many of us are lacking that connection, and many of us are finding that we have to get better at having difficult conversations and to sit with a level of discomfort sometimes, and that we are all going to experience some sadness. And so if there's a way that we can help each other and ourselves, then that would be advantageous.
I personally have a problem with the very Instagrammable, tweetable, it's okay not to be okay sentiment, because I don't think it is okay not to be okay. I think if the message is actually, look, if you're not okay, you can go, there's help available to you, there's people you can talk to, there's stuff you can do about it. I think if that is what we want people to do, then the message that it's okay to accept not being okay, I guess, I think is a dangerous one. And the reason I think that, I guess, is because, as people who listen to the podcast regularly know, and as we've discussed previously, I lost my eldest brother, Stephen, to suicide when he was 25. And so I feel quite strongly that we should encourage people to seek help where appropriate. I wondered how that fits in with, like, the ethos of your book.
Firstly, I'm so sorry, Jen. I'm really sorry for your loss. And I think when I spoke to people who worked with suicide charities and other people who had lost people to suicide, one message that kept coming up was that wouldn't it be more helpful if we were able to talk about how we were feeling? So when we were feeling these low feelings or low moods, or when life events happened that really took our knees out from under us, that we were able to talk about it more. And I think that in a society where the pursuit of happiness and a sort of a very narrow definition of happiness as well, that is very upbeat, perhaps kind of jazz hands, it's success, it's Duran Duran on a yacht, you know, that then it's going to be even harder to say, actually, I'm really not feeling good at the moment. I really need some help. And for men especially, we've seen statistics that it's often harder for men to talk about their emotions, that if we don't start saying, everybody will experience these sad times, but yet there is help if you can talk about it, or if, you know, a friend can sit with you in that sadness so that you don't feel so alone. I think that's what I want to get across, that we will all experience a degree of sadness and losses and heartache in our life. But if we can find a way to articulate it, or even a way to recognize those times around the people around us, the people that we love, then we are better placed to be able to help.
I mean, you're not saying, obviously, that you know, being a bit sad and being depressed are the same thing, are you?
No, not at all. And having experienced both, I can, yeah, categorically confirm that, you know, depression is a chronic mental illness that needs help. But sadness, on the other hand, can be awakening, and it's the temporary emotion that we all feel on occasions we've been hurt or something is wrong in our lives. And sadness is a message. It can tell us what's wrong and what to do about it, but we have to listen, and we have really lost touch with how to listen, I think, as a society.
And do you think then that the danger is that if the sadness isn't acknowledged, it can become a bigger thing than just sadness, in inverted commas?
Yeah, that's certainly true. I think in two respects. So firstly, if we try to suppress our negative thoughts, studies show that that doesn't work. It makes us feel worse. And then also, if as a society, as a culture, we are not okay with sadness, we are not good with sadness, then things tend to get escalated. So people feel more isolated because that we don't feel understood. And then if that sadness is pathologized and told that it needs to be fixed, then there can be a reluctance to kind of come forward.
The book is part memoir and part manifesto, and you do talk about some really personal things that you went through. And I want to sort of start at the start, because I think the stuff that about childhood particularly is really interesting. A really tragic thing happened in your family. Your baby sister died of sudden infant death syndrome when you were three, and then subsequently your parents split not long afterwards. Those things that happened to you at a very young age, they were quite formative for you. And I thought some of the stuff that you said about that was really interesting about children, and how if you don't explain things to them, they will make stuff up. So you came out of it with a feeling that you were somehow responsible for the unhappiness that your parents were experiencing.
I think I was very, very sort of keen that there's, I hope there is sort of universality in the specifics. So this is what happened to me, but everybody has been through different things. And yeah, I think I grew up thinking, oh, it's something to do with me. You know, maybe I am unlovable. If I had been a better daughter, then I might have been able to keep things together, or perhaps it would have been better if I had died instead of my sister. And I had just had these beliefs sort of my whole life, and then digging into it with therapy over the years, and then for this book, it became increasingly clear that I was not special at all. This is a very common reaction for preschoolers, especially, is that children do tend to, as you say, if people don't explain things to children, they will make them up, and what they make up is often far worse than the truth. So however painful it is trying to talk about difficult things with children, if we can do it in an age-appropriate way, that will always be more helpful than trying to gloss over it or pretending everything's fine. And yeah, I certainly believed I was responsible for my parents splitting up, and then I didn't. My dad hasn't really been in my life. So after the age of 13, I didn't see him anymore. And that's very much something that I took on, that, well, that's me, that I am unlovable. As opposed to, of course, you know, our parents are adults, all of us, you know, we are part of their lives, but they are men and women and, you know, or people who have their own stuff going on. So that was really helpful. And I think, as you say, what happens to us in early childhood can have a massive impact on our lives and really influence the way we approach things. And I've always been someone who's craved certainty, who's looked for that stability and that sense of certainty that I really felt was lacking growing up. But being aware of that as an adult and now as a parent myself feels quite important, because now I'm mindful of it and I can see, oh, I'm tending towards this direction, or I am reacting in this way to something because of my own biases there. So yeah, it's been helpful to understand that, and I hope, and I've heard from other readers that it's been helpful to look back. And there's been a lot of study in recent years about the drugs versus not drugs approach to mental health, and I firmly believe there is a place for both, and if people are on medication it's working for them, then that's fantastic. But there's Dr. Lucy Johnston is a great advocate for the idea of asking not what's wrong with you, but what has happened to you. We all have stuff. We all have had experiences or times in our life that have a massive impact on the way we feel, the way we behave. And I think it's important to look at that, and also the circumstances and the structural things, like, you know, like housing, like our education, so that it's not just all on us and something to be fixed in some way.
I've never ever thought of it like that before, but absolutely, it's not what's wrong with you, it's what's happened to you, because we're all a product of our experiences, aren't we? I guess sort of related to that, I have a young daughter, she's 10 months old now, she's my first child, and yeah, one of the things I think about a lot at the moment, I think because of what happened with my brother, I really fear her sadness, and I think a lot about how am I going to explain to her what happened. Obviously we're a long way off having to have that discussion, but like, how do I make her not be sad, basically? How can I make her not kill herself?
And that's huge. And also, having, you know, you're still postpartum 10 months on, that's a lot of going on and a lot of emotions and hormones. I completely understand the compulsion to make everything right. And even after writing this book, my son He saw our dog die when he was 3 years old. And so it just had a massive, massive impact on him. And he's very worried about me dying in particular. And so it's something that we tend to talk about quite a lot. And of course, the compulsion is to say something like, I'm never going to die. Don't worry about it. It'll all be fine. And he also has that thing of certainty, like, well, will we always live in this house? Sweetheart, we might not always live in this house. We don't, you know. And so trying to explain in age-appropriate language that we will all die, and yes, that is sad. And then I completely understand how, with your brother, you are, I guess, hyper-vigilant and hyper-aware of wanting to protect her mental health and the way she feels about it.
Yeah, and others around me. Like, I would say that I definitely, on the basis of that experience, I definitely do fear sadness because I understand what it can lead to, I suppose.
Yeah, and as you said, you know, as we talked about, we're all a product of our environment. So I was hyper-vigilant when the children were small. My mum checked on me in bed every night till I was 16 to check I was still breathing. And I'm a big one of checking, like, nothing near your face and covering to make sure everyone could breathe. And I spoke to someone whose mum was in a car crash when he was three, and was in a coma. And so just his whole childhood, I've just got to be aware it could be danger at every turn. So I think firstly, understanding that that's perfectly natural that you're feeling like that. And then I really now feel that it is really important to be able to normalize sadness when children are children, so that when they fall over, it's not, oh, you're fine, up again. It's like, oh, that must have hurt, so that they then have the vocabulary and to talk about that. So there's some really interesting research that often when children have their emotions minimized, they stop talking about them because they think, well, maybe I'm wrong to feel like this. If they say that they hate something, they're told it's only dislike. Or if they say that something really hurts, they're told it's fine, or get up, or don't cry. And I think that isn't helpful. Now I'm increasingly convinced, and there's lots of studies into this, that if we can try and give children that vocabulary to talk about how they're feeling and not shut down when they're upset, but be with them in it. So not, you know, there was the whole idea of like the naughty step or time out for quite a long time with kids. And now very much the thinking is time in, but you can be sad and you can be having a tantrum, but I'll be sitting next to you and I'll be here with you. And I'm not afraid of your negative, so-called negative emotions. I'm not afraid of your sadness. I can handle it. And that means you can handle it too. Because if we show our kids that it's something terrible, then it will be something that they fear as well. Mm. So the research that I have found most compelling is around that, and that's now what I try and do. I don't always do it right, but that's certainly it's try. And I can see in the playground, I can see other kids being told it's fine, get up, and I'm you know, when the blood is trickling down the knee, like, yeah, that must really hurt, sorry about that, ow, that looks really sore. So from the physical to the emotional, like when a friend doesn't play with them that day, you want to make it better, but I have to really fight that urge.
It's so interesting what you said about the naughty step and the time out and stuff like that, because you're absolutely right. When you think about it logically, if you teach a child that their emotions are bad, so for whatever reason they're throwing a tantrum, like, I want a Kinder Egg or whatever, like, sure, obviously we don't want to encourage that kind of behaviour, but if we teach them that their emotional response to something is bad, they're going to learn that in order to avoid the punishment, they must repress it rather than actually talk about it and say, well, I feel like this because of this.
Yeah, so I think that's really true. And you're way off this stage, but for another book, I ended up speaking to, bear with me, an FBI hostage negotiator.
Ooh.
Who found that actually you can use similar techniques that are used in hostage negotiation when you are dealing with, for instance, toddler tantrums, because you have to, like, get on the floor with them and be with them and show them that you're there, that you're not afraid of this. You're not going to try and overpower. You are meeting them there. And Philippa Perry is very good on this. The book you wish your parents had read.
It's on the list. Don't worry.
Yeah. So that's a really good one of meeting them and picking your battle as well. My daughter walked to school with an Easter bonnet on, some gold sandals, and she wants to be a superhero. So she makes everything a cape. She had like a tablecloth around her and she was carrying her coat, and you could just see all the other parents looking at me. It's fine.
There's a doctor who says that basically children are educated out of knowing what their feelings are. And we say this a lot about men, particularly in society, that the only thing, the only emotion they're allowed to experience and express is rage, basically. And that's why we have the problems that we have in society with, you know, a bunch of things like male suicide, male violence. But we don't talk about that very much in relation to women.
I think traditionally, yes. And I think it's really great people trying not to do that. But I think with the point with men being allowed to pick anger as their emotion from the emotional spectrum, I think conversely, women are often dissuaded from anger. And there's lots of research showing that little girls are still raised that they shouldn't be angry, and so will often go to frustration. And interestingly, I spoke to the tear professor from the Netherlands, Dr. Ad Vingerhoots, and he said that this idea that women cry more, that actually men and women cry the same amount mostly, but that because women are socialized out of expressing anger, they will often cry from frustration and a feeling of powerlessness.
Yeah.
Which certainly rings so many bells. Yeah. I know when I come to the park or if someone like, I just, if something goes wrong and I don't feel I have the power to fix it, it's that weeping from frustration.
So girls are educated out of knowing what their anger is. So what you just said there about frustration is absolutely like bang on the money. The amount of times I've wanted to cry because I felt frustrated about something or even angry.
That links back to the whole, if a child is crying and you tell them don't cry, or if someone falls over and you say up again, you're fine. Yeah, that is being educated out of your feelings, because you have a natural impulse as a child. If you're in pain, you want to express it. If you are hurting emotionally, you want to express it. So I think the way we speak to children is still, yes, often educating them out of really knowing their emotions. And then that takes so much work later on. So if we could just now start to let children have their emotions and help them label them and help them emotionally regulate, we would all be better off.
Helen, so your book, How to Be Sad, Everything I've Learned About Getting Happier by Being Sad Better, is available now, published by the Fourth Estate. And you've also got a podcast series that goes with it, which features lots of excellent guests who we have also featured on Standard Issue, such as Holly McNish, Yomi Adegeke, the brilliant Helen Thorne of Scummy Mummies. Are you going to keep going with that podcast?
Yeah, I've got a taste for it. Yeah, so series two has just launched. And I think especially in this year where we've been lacking that connection, as you know, it's so lovely to be able to have just a focused conversation with someone. So yeah, I'm really enjoying.
Where can we follow you on social media to see what you're up to with the book and future projects and the podcast?
Thank you so much. Yeah, I am on at Ms. Helen Russell, MS Helen Russell, SSSL, on all of the socials.
Thank you so much, Helen.
Hello, I am joined by Lara Parmiani, Artistic Director of Legal Aliens Theatre Company. Lara, hello.
Hello.
First of all, let's talk about theatre with the pandemic. Legal Aliens has been around for 10 years, but it has been a really tricky year for theatre. How have you been?
It's been really hard. Well, it's been really hard for me personally because actually I got sick with COVID almost straight away.
Oh.
So I had that, and then, you know, I lost members of my family. So it's been personally quite a full-on thing. But as a company, also it was a little bit traumatizing because last year in early March we presented a show called Closed Lands at Vault Festival, and it was a premiere, and we thought, oh, you know, after this, you know, a festival is always a way to maybe try things out and experiment, and then you think, oh, we're gonna develop it and maybe tour it in the summer. And of course COVID struck and all that was scrapped straight away.
Yeah.
And it was a show that was also quite topical, and so it's not even something that you can say, okay, we do it in 2 years, you know. It feels mm-hmm. like we wanted to do it there and then, and that wasn't possible. We've been running workshops for migrants and refugees in space in Tottenham. Those were not happening, so it was a lot about trying to reinvent ourselves. The thing that we managed immediately to kind of keep going were the workshops, because we decided to experiment with running workshops on Zoom. And we have this kind of free sessions for migrants, refugees, asylum seekers, and pretty much anyone who can't afford an acting class, really, because sometimes we have people turning up and say, listen, you know, I'm British, will you have me? I'm like, oh, let me think. We don't discriminate against Swedish people. You know, acting classes are so freaking expensive. And so it's a great thing to be able to offer that kind of space. And so we went on Zoom with that, which actually was quite good because we managed to get a lot of participants who were not London-based. Mm-hmm. And we realized that a lot of asylum seekers are completely sent in the middle of nowhere. Yeah, yeah. And where they're completely isolated. They don't have anyone speak their language. So actually, we got more people. So we were very happy with that. But trying to reinvent, you know, given a workshop that was very often based on kind of physicality on Zoom was quite something. And then, yeah, then we were trying to see what else could happen. And I think the only good thing that happened in theatre, which to be fair, I'm not sure whether it's going to continue. I hope, but I'm not completely positive, is that there was a lot of talking all of a sudden about reinventing theatre, and people made themselves quite available. So we were part of like the discourse on, you know, how can we create a different kind of theatre? And we were the founding members of a new organisation called Migrants in Theatre. So we did that a lot, trying to lobby for kind of a wider representation of artists. Yeah, that happened. And because people were all at home, pretty much, there was a lot of time to have all those conversations, even with people in position of power. So even through conversations with some very kind of open artistic directors, and I really want to mention the New Diorama Theatre and David Byrne for being incredibly, you know, supportive of artists. Mm-hmm. We were encouraged to put in an application for another kind of Arts Council grant, just doing something digitally, which is why we decided to do the podcast and trying to kind of see how we could translate our approach to theatre to a purely kind of audio environment. That was last year pretty much for us.
You have adapted and you've gone into audio. So first of all, a big welcome to the world of podcasting. Come on in. The water's lovely. And Things I Am Not is a collection of 10 original audio monologues from international professional female artists who have made the UK their home. And the series explores migrant experiences with immigration, racism, misogyny, and like loads more. I mean, I can guess a lot of the reasons you felt compelled to commission this now. Brexit. No racism in Britain. Yeah, whatever. But can you tell us why and how Things I Am Not came about?
Yeah, absolutely. First of all, I have to kind of confess, it wasn't my idea to begin with. Like, I have a colleague and friend called Emanuela Lia. She's an actor originally from Greece. She came to me about a year ago saying, listen, I wrote this piece. I used lockdown to write a monologue called Things I'm Not. But, you know, I don't know what to do with it. What do you think that this could have a life somewhere? And so I talked about it with Becca McFadden, who's my associate and artistic director. And we thought, well, what a brilliant title and what a brilliant provocation. We are a group of theatre makers. We are all women in the core team. Why don't we actually use this provocation to ask more artists like us to tell us about the thing that they are not, by starting with this kind of negative, actually affirming the things that they are?
Yeah.
Because I think that's it's about really getting rid of the stereotypes and then saying, this is what we really want to talk about. It felt really timely. There's a lot of different things happening at the same time. Obviously, you know, the Me Too movement never really died and it keeps returning, you know, all this kind of talk about how women obviously keep being the subject of all this kind of violence. But apart from the big violence and also, you know, the hostile environment and Brexit and all the new legislation, do you know what? It's just migration is a kind of, you know, what do you call it? Those kind of words where, you know, you say to a dog and everyone's like, you know, there seems to be a part of the population.
A Pavlov's dog responds to it. Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Then there's that whistle and go, you know.
She just did an excellent impression of Nigel Farage. It was incredible.
Yeah, do you know what I mean? And it's still happening. And so, but there is always talking about whether it's women, whether it's migrants, whether in very general terms and in the very macro terms. So people think about people arriving on a dinghy and people who are destitute asking for benefits. And there's all this kind of big images. And what people don't understand is actually the day-to-day reality of people who are migrants in this country. Some of us have been here for a long time and who keep actually meeting all this kind of microaggressions that are really kind of, you know, it's like drop, 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 you know. Yeah. Next week, there's going to be a monologue by South Korean artist. It's beautiful because she says, I keep saying sorry and I keep saying I'm okay, but I'm not okay. And it feels like, yes, of course, you know, I am not in one of those kind of horrible situations where, you know, you're completely destitute and arriving with nothing, escaping from the war. But that doesn't mean that people like us don't actually meet constantly situations that make you feel really small and make you feel like you can't say anything almost. It's like, oh, you know, but at the end of the day, I am here. Maybe I should just be grateful. And I think especially as women, very often we're made to feel like that anyway. And as a foreign woman in this country, sometimes it's even more. We gave artists this kind of freedom of talking about this negative, getting to a positive as they pleased. And I think the beauty was to find out that even though these 10 people worked completely on their own individually, then when we read all the monologues, there were some recurrent themes and recurrent words even that we found quite extraordinary. So I thought, okay, we really tapped into an experience that is there, is shared by many people, but nobody really talks about. And so we became really excited about what we found.
I wanted to ask you, actually, because obviously these 10 women who have made these pieces of theatre are from all over the world. And like you say, there are common themes. I've listened to 5 of the podcasts, and even just in listening to half of them, there are common themes that come up. And so I wanted to ask you what you thought those common themes were.
There is this sense of having to be constantly adapting. My monologue, I wrote one, is called Shape Shifting. And Sabrina Richmond, who is an artist from South Africa, who is going to be the last one, we didn't talk about it. And she uses the same word, shape shifting.
Right.
And it's like, you know, I'm from Italy. She's a black woman from South Africa. Instead, we pick the same word. There is this theme, the theme of feeling isolated and stupid because you didn't speak as a native person. That's another theme, you know, it's how people make you feel when you make a mistake, or the fear. I think 3 of us talk about the fear of talking on the phone and somebody gives you an address, or they give you some information that is quite important. And 2 people, I think, talked about talking with doctors on the phone, and they speak too fast. And, you know, you want to access medical care and all of a sudden you're not sure what they are saying to you. The visa nightmare is it's another thing. You know, you hear on the radio, especially after Brexit, oh, you know, what's the big deal? You just get a visa. Yeah, you try and get a visa, especially as an artist. Artists, are we useful? Now there is this thing with the Home Office, you know, you get points if what you do is useful. Is art useful? I mean,
I'd say a big yes, but I'm not part of the government.
Do you know what I mean? And then there are some very specific themes, like we have 2 women in the group who both had experiences as refugees, one as a child from Iran and another one from Iraq as a kind of a young woman. And they both talked about how strange it is to basically flee to the country that has caused you to flee in the first place.
That's really interesting. Yeah.
Lana, her family ran away to the United States, which was part of, you know, the reasons why Iran became what it became. And then she came to Britain. And Yasmin, I think she went first to Lebanon and then to Britain. And again, you know, Britain was part of the Iraq war. And so it's quite interesting for them to be trying to be artists in the country that partially people back home really resent. It's that kind of duality. And duality is another theme. Mireille Sildam, she is Egyptian originally, but she migrated as a child. And so again, she now has a British accent, but she lives surrounded at home by a culture that is her parents' culture. So, you know, how do you negotiate, especially if you migrate as a child, you're desperate to fit in, and then you almost feel like you're betraying where you're coming from, which is something that probably even second generation migrants feel a lot. Who feel almost like suspended between two cultures.
So one that I noticed was that female foreign bodies are often objectified and sexualized.
Yeah.
And that comes up in Gail Lacornick's piece. She's Brazilian.
Yeah.
It comes up in Mireille Sidhomme's piece, who you've just mentioned, who's Egyptian.
Yeah.
And also in Sabrina Richmond's piece, who you also mentioned, she's from South Africa. And obviously women's bodies being sexualized isn't something only experienced by migrant women, but there seems to be this extra sharp edge to it. So for instance, the word exotic isn't the compliment it's often portrayed as at all, is it?
No, yeah, absolutely. It's this kind of, you're seen as exotic, so you're seen as kind of a strange creature. And then there is all the kind of things associated with being exotic. So certain people being almost like this kind of dark, predatory seductress, that you know, the family wrecker and you know, the lover and all that. For other, for instance, partially In Young touches on it as well. For East Asian women and also Southeast Asian women, there is much more a sense, oh, you're exotic and perceived as quite tame.
Mm-hmm.
In people's imagination, that's, you know, East Asian women often come with this idea of being very nice, so you know, kind of ready to please. So there's a lot attached to exotic. And what happens when you don't feel like, because for instance, you know, I am Italian, and again, Italian women, Monica Bellucci, I'm 5'1" and completely flat chested. So I remember looking for work as an actor, and it's like, Italian, curvy, seductive, think Monica Bellucci. And I'm like, yeah, great. Sure, I'm here.
Do you know who looks like Monica Bellucci? Monica Bellucci, that's it.
Exactly. Yeah, because, you know, you go to Italy and it's full of women looking like Monica Bellucci. We are all like that.
I guess we've covered some of the reasons in our chat so far, but how are female migrants treated differently from male migrants?
Well, obviously, there's a lot of stuff in common. The stuff about language, for instance, surely is shared by both male and female. I think, as we were saying, the main difference is how our bodies are perceived. Mm-hmm. And this feeling of being exotic. And I think we get patronized quite a bit as well. There is a sense of always feeling this need to justify yourself and to change shape and to protect yourself and your body. And I think that is specifically female. I think often, and we are talking stereotype, the stereotype of the male migrant is, you know, the benefit scrounger or the aggressive one, the potential criminal. You know, there's a lot of things attached to the idea of male migrants.
Mm-hmm.
Or all this kind of idea that migrants are all there to take something from you is usually male. I think for female, either we're seen as the victim or, as I said, you know, as the beautiful body. Also in terms of visas, and that comes up in Becca McFadden's monologue, also there are some very strange types of visas that are attached to spouses that are particularly used by women. And, you know, so there is almost like the assumption you are here as somebody else's attachment.
Yep. As we record, 7 out of 10 stories from Things I Am Not are available for a listen, and you absolutely should do that. So where can people do that, please?
There are several ways you can access the podcast. You can go on the website, which is thingsiamnot.com, or you can look it up on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts. Also, what I wanted to say is that the podcast is interactive, so you can actually send us your creative responses if you feel so inclined.
I've got one last question to squeeze in, and that is that Legal Aliens was set up to bridge a gap in British theatre when it comes to representation. And as I said, you've been going 10 years as a theatre company, and you've been living in the UK for 23 years. So I wondered, how is that gap looking these days? Have things changed for the better? She asked optimistically.
You know what? It's a very strange thing. I moved to this country in the midst of the new Labour things can only get better kind of situation. So where everyone thought it was like, hey, we're so cool, Britannia, Spice Girls, you know, that was the situation. And at the time, I felt incredibly peculiar. I felt like I was the only one who wasn't British trying to do theatre. The theatre was incredibly just white, British and middle class, I would say. Mm-hmm. But funnily enough, there seemed to be at the time more interest towards international theatre. So although in terms of diversity, it was very white, British, middle class, I don't think that migrants or foreigners were seen as a possible threat somehow. So in a way, there was a certain amount of curiosity for what was going on outside Britain. And then I think there was a shift in culture. There was the big 2008 crisis and so on. And then migrants became, as we were saying before, the scapegoat for pretty much everything that was going wrong in this country. On one side, there was this great kind of awareness that theatre had to be more diverse. So there were much more initiatives to include Black, Asian people. Anyone who wasn't white, there's finally more awareness about trying to include people who are not working class, disabled people, more attention to gender, etc. But the international side, I really felt, was politicized. For me, I felt almost like venues and producers were scared of looking too international because there was this kind of growing nationalism going on that was permeating so many things. It felt like things were really going backwards. And now, through lockdown, funnily enough, and through all these conversations, through movements like Migrants in Theatre, Migrants in Culture, there seems to be a little bit of a gap to try and have those conversations and say, okay, great, you have acknowledged that theatre needed to be more diverse, but diversity should also include migrants. It should include anyone who's part of our communities.
Yep.
Because some people say, you know, why do you call yourself migrant and not an international artist? And I think we kind of claim the word back for ourselves because, first of all, bureaucratically and according to the Home Office, that's what we are. But more to the point, because I think international kind of suggests, like, when Juliette Binoche comes to the Barbican, she's an international artist. You know, she lives in France, she's a star, she does her show and goes home. Well, we live here.
Laura, this has been so fascinating. And having listened to, like I say, 5 out of 10, I heartily recommend that our listeners, listening to all our podcasts, obviously, they go and listen to your podcast because it is brilliant.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You play ball like a girl!
Go on, do one, kid. Jenny off the blocks.
Welcome to Jenny Off the Blocks, that time of the week where we stick the patriarchy in the sin bin as we discuss all things women's sport. I'm referring, of course, to the rugby there, and in case you missed it, which you might have done, to be fair, because the patriarchy. Specifically, I'm talking about the Women's Six Nations, which concluded last weekend. As the leaders of their respective pools, England took on France at Twickenham. It was a closely fought match, played largely defensively, and though England led by 7-0 after the first half, the French team fought back in the second to put them under pressure. On the verge of collapse, Emily Scarrett scored a penalty to put the Red Roses in front and secured their third consecutive win at the tournament. Excellent stuff. Now on to less exciting news, which you'll no doubt have seen reported on excessively even. The ill-fated European Super League, which lasted only slightly longer than Germany's 1940 invasion of Denmark. 6 hours, fact fans. Twitter was at its absolute finest, I have to say. And my favourite meme, although there were many, was of Steve Coogan as Guy Hennity, if you remember, the spoof soap opera The Bureau on the very excellent The Day Today, saying, "I'm joining the European Super League for an hour." That was lols. But yeah, what a bunch of absolute bellends the owners of the so-called Big Six Premier League clubs are. In case you don't know what I'm talking about, along with a few Spanish and Italian clubs, Manchester City, Manchester United, Arsenal, Tottenham, Liverpool and Chelsea announced last week that they were starting their own league. A bit like the Champions League, except that they were guaranteed places in it every season, unlike in the Champions League, regardless of their success in their own domestic tournaments. So, like, you know, not very competitive, but, like, you know, loads of guaranteed money to take back to the Premier League and continue to widen the financial disparity between them and the rest of the teams in the league. Oh, and with no thought or consideration of the impact, they were going to take their women's teams with them to enter into their own non-competitive competitive league. And I am talking about men's football here, so apologies for that. But here are some more facts for you, fact fans. Spurs haven't won a domestic league for 60 years. They've not won at a UEFA Cup for almost 40 years. They've not won an FA Cup for 30 years. And they've not even won a Football League Cup for more than a decade. It's actually only in the last decade that they've finished consistently in the top six. And in that last decade, they've only finished in the top four six times. In fairness, I could be similarly disparaging about Arsenal, and I'd certainly have some words about Manchester United on the basis of their performance over the last few years. Let's face it, Chelsea and Manchester City are only up there because their squads are entirely manufactured through exorbitant wealth. But let's stick with Spurs for a minute, because if you're talking about competing with the creme de la creme of European football, I'm sorry, but that is an embarrassing record. I mean, there is so much that's wrong with this, it's hard to know where to start. And that is a view shared by an overwhelming majority of fans. And I'm not talking like 52% overwhelming majority, I'm talking like basically everyone, who rightly kicked off about the planned league. And by the end of the day, Manchester City and Chelsea were already out of it, with the entire thing collapsing the following day. Since the formation of the league was announced, there were political interventions, people left their jobs, fans literally took to the streets in protest, FIFA condemned it. It was big. But as you may have picked up on in today's BT, I'm unlikely to be taking any lessons on moral values from FIFA, or Boris Johnson for that matter. And certainly not Oliver Dowden, he can fuck right off. I think you are quite right to be pissed off about it, and I enjoyed seeing football fans coming together as a force for good. I just think it's interesting how we apply our moral compasses when it comes to football. For example, absolutely fine to go ahead with a World Cup next year, which we all know is being built by people who are working in conditions that can only be described as modern slavery. Racism and other forms of discrimination are bad, but, you know, why don't we take ourselves off social media rather than the perpetrators of said discrimination? Okay, makes absolutely no sense to me, but fine. And as ever, the women's game remains an afterthought, really, in the inception of the league and in the protests against it. The whole thing really does smack of some dudes in suits discussing it. Oh, what about the women's league, though? They have a Champions League as well. Oh, do they? Oh, okay, well, we'll have a Super League for them too then. Why not? You people want equality. Anyway, some better, albeit slightly frustrating news about women's football. You may remember we spoke about a groundbreaking new deal for broadcast rights to the Women's Super League a little while ago on this very podcast. Well, as part of a new report which was published last week, a survey of 5,000 football fans found that, no way for it, there is an appetite for women's football. In fact, the Run Repeat survey found that if the women's game were actually easily accessible to watch on TV in the UK, it would see a 296.7% increase in viewers. Now, I find that a slightly tricky stat because under current circumstances, it's not regularly easily accessible on the TV. So what is a 296% rise in no one? And what I mean by that is it's not clear to me from the information they've put out what they're counting as the current viewing figures. Is it all the currently available women's football on all the channels? I just don't know. But I would say it's patently fucking obvious that more people would watch it if it were easy to watch. Similarly, I think more people would go to watch matches in person if women's matches weren't largely played in random and inaccessible training pitches in the middle of nowhere, as opposed to actual stadiums and grounds nearby proper infrastructure. I don't drive, for example, and I live in London, so if I wanted to take Lyra to see Charlton Women's, I don't know how I would actually do it. An interesting thing, I thought, however, was that the survey also found that considerably more men currently watch women's football than do women. And that's like 61% to about 34%. I actually don't find that surprising at all. I think football fans watch football, and more football fans are men. And if we want to tap into that market, we need to start making it more accessible in lots of ways other than just putting it on the telly. But I will come back to that point another time. That's all from me this week, and I'll be back next time with more women's sport.
Welcome to Rated or Dated. Hannah, in an odd twist on my usual feelings, which film made me ever so grateful for my sports bra this week?
This week we watched 1981's Gregory's Girl, which I referred to last week as the only British rom-com that existed when I was growing up. Now that's clearly an exaggeration, but not much of one. I think it's easy for anyone who doesn't remember the British film industry pre-1994 to believe that it was always thriving, and that was very much not the case. Whatever you make of Four Weddings and a Funeral and Richard Curtis's oeuvre in general, it should be noted that it altered the fortunes of the British rom-com. What I mean when I say it was the only British rom-com when I was growing up is that if you asked people to name one, Gregory's Girl would have been their likely response, whether they'd seen it or not. And despite all of this, until last week, I hadn't. Set in and around a Cumbernauld secondary school and rocking what I could only call a Grange Hill aesthetic, the coming-of-age comedy was written and directed by Bill Forsyth and stars John Gordon Sinclair, Dee Hepburn and Claire Grogan. It was released to favourable reviews and ranked number 30 in the British Film Institute's list of the top 100 British films and number 29 on Entertainment Weekly's list of the 50 best high school movies. Made on a shoestring, the cast often had to wear their own or borrowed clothes, although Dee Hepburn was given 6 weeks of football training at Partick Thistle to play Dorothy, the girl who replaces the titular Gregory as the team striker. I know our listeners north of the border are going to be fidgeting in their seats, wondering why there's a certain word I've not yet mentioned, so here goes. Gregory's Girl is a mix of ribaldry, surrealness, understated sentiment, effortless charm, and young children swearing. Is there a word that encompasses all of that? Sure there is. Scottish. The film was dubbed with anglicised Scottish accents, whatever that means, for the original American theatre release. Although it wasn't just the Yanks who struggled with the accent. Legendary film critic Barry Norman admitted, I couldn't understand some of the cast's accents. Didn't stop him being a big fan, though. In fact, he later described Bill Forsyth as one of the most influential original voices who'd ever worked in the British film industry. And he wasn't alone in marking Forsyth as a singular talent. He won the BAFTA for Best Original Screenplay for Gregory's Girl and also received a London Critics Circle Film Award, the Special Achievement Award. So, the plot for our non-Scottish listeners goes thus. Ludicrously long-legged Gregory, played by Sinclair, is drifting somewhat obliviously through life, hanging out with his friends who have one good jacket between them, peeping on women. And yes, we will revisit that in a bit. His life changes when he is removed as a striker for his school's football team. And when the PE teacher advertises for a replacement, Dorothy turns up and immediately ups the quality of the team by about 1,000%. Instead of resenting her for this, Gregory becomes infatuated to the degree that he almost becomes a feminist. That modern girls, modern boys, it's tremendous line I quoted earlier is just double chef's kiss, if that is a thing. And that's about it for the plot. In the tradition of all great teen dramas, it's just about being a teenager. That might explain why Gregory's Two Girls, a follow-up made in 1999, didn't capture the imagination so much, although to be clear, I have not watched that. So, let's start with you, Jen. What did you make of Gregory's Girl?
I thought it was all right. I thought that the acting was not great in a lot of it, and that turned me off a bit, I have to say. I know most of them are kids, and so that's a slightly unfair criticism in a way. But yeah, it wasn't like my favourite thing in the world. I thought she was a very good footballer. I thought she actually was a very good footballer, and I liked the plot a lot. And I did think that John Gordon Sinclair was a very charming lead as well. And it's something I thought about quite a lot as a teenager, about girls playing on boys' football teams and, you know, whether that was a thing that might happen at some point in the future. So, yeah, it's a nice plot and it's, you know, it was all right. That's what I thought.
Mickey?
I thought it was a delight. I was
utterly
charmed by it. I'd seen it before, and quite a few times, actually. There was a period when it was on the telly all the time, and it felt like, actually, when you suggested we were going to watch it, I was like, oh, I think I've seen this too many times. But I don't think I'd sat and watched it all the way through, and I certainly haven't done that as an adult. And I just thought it really beautifully and gently captured all of the tumultuousness that goes with being a teenager. And I love that it doesn't do the usual rom-com stuff. Sure, Dorothy is the idol for all of the boys in the school. And a little bit of a spoiler alert, Gregory's girl at the end is not Dorothy. She sets him up with someone that she thinks will suit him better.
I'm not even sure that Gregory's girl at the end of it is Claire Grogan. The person that Gregory tells is his girl at the end of him. Is his little sister, which is really delightful.
It's really,
really
lovely.
Delightful.
And obviously, we're going to talk about this scene, so I'm going to bring it up. The scene at the beginning that opens the film is a group of teenage boys perving on a woman who does not know she's being watched getting undressed through a window. And it was a bit like, oh my God, is this going to be like Confessions of a Scottish Teenager? But even that...
window cleaner.
Even that is kind of sweet, because one of them is so overcome by the sight of tits that he faints. And it's just... I don't want to use the phrase boys going to be boys, but it is that, you know, that curiosity goes both ways, of the girls wanting to know about the boys wanting to know about the girls. This is a very heteronormative, obviously, film. But that curiosity goes both ways, and the girls are trying to find out about the boys as well. And what makes it a feminist film, I think, is that when Dorothy gets on the football team, the PE teacher is a little bit dubious at first, and then he just celebrates her and is like, yes, she's great. The head teacher says, I think this is amazing. The kids don't treat her like a freak. They treat her like she's some sort of hero. And it's just accepted. Is it a little bit odd? Yes, because it would have been a little bit odd. But after the initial, oh, if women were meant to play football, their tits would be somewhere else line, they all just get on with it.
There is a bit of a weird bit, though, when she's playing football and then afterwards, like, she basically gets, like, touched and kissed and whatever by, like, literally every other boy on the pitch.
Isn't it more of a celebration because she scores a goal? I think it's like when Hannah last week pulled a T-shirt over her head and did a knee slide.
I felt it was a bit more, like, pouring at her than that. And she didn't seem to mind. It seemed to all be, like, done in good spirits. I just think, like, that wouldn't happen today.
Well, Gregory is outraged by it, but Gregory is outraged by it because he doesn't get it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think actually that's really key as well, something you've said there, Jen. She doesn't seem to mind. Throughout everything, the person in control in this film is Dorothy. Mm. The girls are the ones in control. The boys are just like, please let me even get close to them and let me tell them about how veal is made. Is that a chat up line? I don't know. I just want to talk to a woman. And the girls are like, oh, for God's sake. Or they lead the way. And I thought that was just so lovely. I was utterly, utterly charmed by it. And just John Gordon Sinclair, who obviously is Gordon John Sinclair in this, but then had to change his name for equity reasons. Just him just running around the playground, trying to sneak into the school, is hilarious physical comedy because he is 6'2" and gangly. Yeah, I loved it. I had a lovely time.
He's got some beautiful lines, just some absolutely cracking lines. But at the start, I was like, ah, shit. And what won it over for me was that period of, about 5 minutes, which is pretty early on, when... The first thing that really made me laugh, because I can say it's quite surreal, is that he is like the tallest person on earth, and yet he has a long mirror in his bedroom that goes widthways. And I don't know why, but that really amused me. And then he's making that catastrophic amount of noise in the kitchen, and then he goes out and there's all those babies, which is so surreal but yet so funny. And then his dad tries to get someone to run him over in an emergency stop. And I just thought, I don't know, once I'd clicked into that part of That's Why It's Funny, the whole thing became funny. There's so many funny lines. I wrote down a few, but I think my favourite might be, have you given the petty shoe any more thought? Which is just, like, only if you do it in a Scottish accent is it funny. But also, if I die, my mother gets her windows squashed for 25 years, which is really funny. And when the school journalist turns up to talk to her, because it's a big story for the school newspaper, because Dorothy's playing on the team and they're discussing whether they're going to use her or the girl that had the triplets. That's the story, which again is just ridiculously funny, I thought.
There's a bit when they're selling posters of her and I can't remember what the line is, but it's quite nice. So sorry, this isn't ideal because I don't remember what it was. But there's a bit where he's selling posters of her and he's like, oh, you charge me 25p or whatever. And he's like, yeah. Oh, I don't make the rules or whatever. Talk, like, to the boss. Talk to the boss or something like that. And it's just like, it's very good. No, there were bits about it that I found to be, you know, funny and charming and whatever. The Peeping Tom thing, I didn't think that was like offensive per se, because I think you're right, it's curiosity more than anything else. And I think it's probably quite realistic as well. That's probably the kind of shit that little boys got up to. I don't know, not that little boys, teenagers, I guess. But I did find it a bit odd in what is ostensibly like a kid's film, right? It's for teenagers, I would have thought it's pitched at.
See, I
rather
think
than adults.
Most films made about teenagers aren't for teenagers, they're for adults. Yes. Who then remember what it's like to be a teenager.
I agree with that, but in terms of, like, classification, what was the classification of it?
PG, it was.
See, that's quite interesting, I think, that it's a PG with tits in. That, again, that you wouldn't get that now, I don't think.
Yeah, maybe not. Do you know what is really interesting about it, too? And this isn't just because it's Scottish, but watching it, I could see it as a massive forerunner to Trainspotting. That humour,
absolutely.
The way it's done, the naturalistic performances, but with that surrealism in there as well.
The little boy with the crazy thick hair, the one that likes looking at trucks, his friend, who's got just incredibly thick hair.
All got incredibly
tiny
thick
head,
hair.
And the one that likes looking at trucks.
Okay.
He is really a proto-spud, I would say. Yeah, everything about him seems really spuddish. But I also think that the sort of the surreal angle, there's a lot of absolutely that I think probably drew the comedy series that probably drew on this
absolutely.
As well. Yeah, the stuff that's going on in the background. That, I mean, there's a penguin walking around in the background of this for no apparent reason, and it's just silly, but silly in a way that feels quite Scottish. Mm.
There's a really famous Scottish comedian in it. Is he called Chick Parker? I might have got his name wrong.
I think so, yeah.
And he is, I think he's supposed to be the head of the school because he's in the robes. And just when he's playing the piano, just because he wants to play the piano, and he goes, oh, small boys, go away. He just shoes them on. There are so many moments that made me just giggle and smile. Yeah, I really enjoyed. I'm saying it again, I really enjoyed myself.
We talked about this the other day, the scene where he's teaching her a move and
the
they
offside
do
trap.
It over and over again and end up dancing is lovely. It's really just a lovely, charming scene.
Yeah, the offside trap becomes disco dancing. And the PE teacher, I think, obviously he's growing his little moustache. He is the stereotypical PE teacher in that he's kind of mocked by the other teachers who have girls who are sending them love notes. And they are very like, no, they're 13, there's no way, which is really nice. But it's like, oh God, is he going to be portrayed as a bit creepy now? There's a girl on his team. And he's not, he's an outsider as well, and he just welcomes her and wants her to be a better footballer. And then there's a gorgeous moment later when you just see him through the glass of his greenhouse. You can't hear him, but he's talking to his plants in the same way he talks to the members of his football team. Adorable. John Gordon Sinclair's in Traces now, which is Val McDermid and Amelia Bullmore's series, isn't it? Mm. Yeah, he's in that now because he just sort of vanished. He didn't really do much else. Acting wise, but now he's back on the telly box if you want to see more of his lovely gangliness.
His ridiculously long legs. One other thing, I've kind of mentioned him, the window cleaner. I think there's something else that's really spot on, which is that he's a year older than them, that kid, and he's left school. And how you feel about people who are older and are in the real world. I thought that was done really well, that they all sort of follow around. He's like a man now and they're all still boys and they treat him like that. And he's talking about stuff that's really stupid and they're like, ooh, because, yeah, he is a man in their eyes.
He's got that life experience.
And yeah, as an adult, you can look and go, no, he's just a year older than you. That's all that is.
He's got a job, though, hasn't he? He's got a job that might, in some way, grant him more access to women. And that seems to be their... Like, it's a goal that they don't massively try to follow through. And it does feel... It could have felt really pervy and like, oh, God, women as objects. But it just feels really innocent. You know, when Gregory does end up on a date with Claire Grogan, what do? They lie on the grass and they dance. And it's just so sweet and innocent. And actually, he's nervous. He's as nervous as she is. The teenagers aren't like... So Porky's came out at the same time. And Porky's is like drilling holes so that they can look into the girls' changing rooms. It's tits and arse. The boys are those American sort of super studs. And this isn't, this is the antithesis of this. This is more like reality, which is like everyone's just trying to work out what the fuck to do with the opposite sex.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think I know what everyone's going to say, but for the sake of sticking to the format, Gregory's girl, rated or dated?
I thought it was a bit dated in some ways, but that's not to say it wasn't charming.
It's very 80s, but absolutely rated for me.
Yeah, I would agree. Rated.
Jen, we're having some more masculinity next week, aren't we?
We are. Very, very masculine indeed. I've never watched this film the whole way through, which is why I'm picking it. Next week, we are watching Highway to the Danger Zone. Top Gun.
It's also what I call my pubic hair, the Highway to the Danger Zone.
I thought you had Top Gun. I was like, what?
And Top Gun.
Standard Issue for all women.